Your talk on CITR 101.9, and I'm up to my old tricks. I'm watching a lot of TV shows about astronomy, and even though I've seen them before, sometimes when you see it again, it just reinforces things and makes things clearer, and you think about it more, and I've been doing a lot of thinking about these things. So one of the things that I have been thinking about is something about string theory and quantum phone and the Planck length, things that are very at the small scale of astronomy and physics. And I will talk about that in a minute, but first got to clear up some things. There's three things going on in Mars now. Well, more going on, but three new things. The United Arab Emirates have, I think it's a spacecraft orbiting Mars or close to orbiting Mars. The Chinese also have one, and they're doing tests on Mars. And the Americans have a brand new vehicle coming there soon. And it's going to land, and it's going to have a helicopter. So there's lots going on Mars. And I don't want to, let's say, I want to be very delicate. But everybody has their own interests. And I'm sure if I had an astronomer or even a geologist explain things about Mars to me, I think, wow, that's so cool. And of course, I've heard that many billions of years ago, or I'm not sure, a few billion years ago, Mars had liquids on its surface. So did it have life? As we know, Mars is the most studied planet after the Earth. And I guess I can say for this, for the stars, I think it's Betelgeuse is the most studied star after our sun. So there's lots going on Mars, and I'm just going to mention those because actually I was more intrigued about the thing about string theory and quantum foam and the Planck length, so I'll go on about that. But anyway, congratulations to the United Arab Emirates. They have a space program. They have something going on Mars. And they also, China has something going on Mars, and the Americans are really making more inroads into Mars. And one of the things that I did remember, one of their rovers, is it couldn't dig very deep. So their new things are going to do a lot of the limitations that Americans have faced before on Mars. I think they can dig deeper. As I said, they have a helicopter. So they're getting more and more more interesting things are happening on Mars, and I believe Elon Musk said he will be, or somehow he will land people on Mars within 5 years, and that's so exciting because so many things, like as I said before, the older George Bush promised we'd be on Mars. That's what I thought he said in the year 2000, and it's 2021 now, and we're not there. And it could be like 20, 30 years off. So hopefully something like that can happen. But there is exciting things happening with the Artemis program around the moon. And within 5 years, hopefully people will be shuttling up and down from a space station that orbits the moon. But now let's talk about string theory and quantum gravity. So let me read something quickly about quantum gravity. This is WikiLeaks. And it says, with an incomplete theory of quantum gravity, it is impossible to be certain what space-time would look like at small scales. However, there is no reason that space-time needs to be fundamentally smooth. It is possible that instead, in a quantum theory of gravity, space-time would consist of many small, ever-changing regions in which space and time are not definite, but fluctuate in a foam-like manner. So I guess a lot of astronomers, some of them at UBC, they study this stuff, and maybe they've taken courses in it. And I've heard about quantum foam. But basically, I guess what it is, it's not smooth. So what does that mean? Because when I heard of things like quite a few years ago, I would hear things like, oh, string theory, it's the new thing. It's going to explain everything. And so far, it hasn't. And there's all kinds of models, like maybe there's WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, that can explain what exactly dark matter or dark energy is. Because as we know, there's a lot in the universe, like maybe 95% or 96%, that is either dark matter or dark energy, and scientists basically have no idea what it is. And they also don't know the physics of what happens inside a black hole. So there's lots that physics has not explained, and maybe some things have to be modified. But again, I'll refer to this string theory where, because I've been an astronomer for maybe 30 years now, when I've been watching programs, there's a lot more programs on the TV station now with BBC Earth, and they just talked about string theory. But it's been quite a few years now that I've heard that string theory was going to be the be-all and end-all. It was going to answer everything that we needed to know. And what they concluded in the show, which is a few years old, that there's been no experimental evidence about string theory. And I might be wrong, but that's what I heard from the show. So then they talked to an astronomer in Rome, and he has this special telescope, or this collector of light, or whatever it is. And he said, we got to study things at the Planck level to understand exactly how to unify the force of gravity, or general relativity, and quantum mechanics. So I hope I'm saying that correctly, because sometimes you can say, well, this thing is 10 times bigger than this other thing. Does that mean it has 10 times bigger radius or 10 times bigger volume? Because if it had a 10 times bigger radius, then the volume is 4/3 pi r cubed. So the radius is 10 cubed, which is 1,000 times bigger. So sometimes you can say something's bigger, but you have to specify what you're actually talking about. So when I'm talking about stuff that I'm not an expert in, and very few people in the world know about quantum foam, quantum gravity, all this cosmological stuff, it's very interesting, it's very intriguing. Of course, it made me think. So when I say the wrong word, please try to understand that I'm trying not to say the wrong word. But anyway, this astronomer was talking about investigate things at the Planck length, and then you might find answers. So what's the Planck length? Well, apparently, I think it is. It's the shortest distance possible in physics. And in this BBC Earth program, they said, well, the Planck length, if you take a quark, which is super small, smaller than an electron, because electrons are made of quarks, then you can, you'd have to get, the Planck length is 10 million billion times smaller than the size of a quark. So it's very small. It's hard to see something that small, because I don't think we've even seen electrons. Maybe we have, but anyway. So the astronomer says, if we examine the data from what happens at the Planck length, maybe that could be just as good. It could tell us something, and it could furnish some information to all these physicists, and they can think about it. So basically, they were saying, so at the Planck length, space-time is not smooth. It fluctuates in a foam-like manner. So there's quantum foam, like if you say espresso, cup of coffee, you can see the foam bubbles. Maybe at the Planck length, that's what space-time looks like. So so let me read this a bit more about this. I don't want to just read an article and tell you what you can read, so I'll say this. Wheeler suggested that the Heisenberg uncertainty principle might imply that over sufficiently small distances and sufficiently brief intervals of time, the very geometry of space-time fluctuates. These fluctuations could be large enough to cause significant departure from the smooth space-time seen at macroscopic scales, giving space-time a foamy character. So I've heard about space, or this quantum foam, and of course all these intriguing puzzles, that these nuts we have to crack, of course it gets some people thinking. So as I said, it's like if I'm told something about Mars and I listen to an expert on Mars, I'll say, wow, that's fascinating. That is very interesting. And if I, like I said before, I never was interested in life in the universe before, but when I was listening to these experts talk about it, It's very, very supreme, superbly interesting. But I guess this cosmology gets me going more than anything else, so I'm going to talk about that. And of course, if I just read something from the computer, then blah. So I'm going to try to talk about what I said. And here's one interesting thing on this WikiLeaks article. It says relationship of quantum foam to other theories. So maybe I'll touch on that a bit. But anyway, this astronomer from Italy has a special telescope. He rides a motorcycle, and he says examine things at the quantum, at the Planck length, and maybe that can tell you what you're looking for, something about what you're looking for. So what he said was he was examining a, I guess it's an active galactic nuclei, maybe a quasar it's called, that's 7 billion light years away. So examine the light from that and see if you can, from the light you examine at that far, far distance, the light that we receive, is there something that that light can tell us about what happens at the Planck length, or something about quantum foam, or something about unifying gravity, quantum gravity, oh no, sorry, I'm sorry, general relativity and quantum mechanics. So basically, what the conclusion was, there was a telescope that somehow sensed, so I don't know how they could do this, but they get light just from this one point in space, 7 billion light years away. They received the light and they examined that. And what the conclusion was, they were examining different wavelengths of light, and they were examining, of course, gamma rays, the most energetic and shortest wavelengths of light. And then they were examining other wavelengths of light. And I'm going to tell you something which will explain somebody that might question their result. And this is what the person said. I'll say that after I give the result. So the result was there was a difference in time from the wavelength or the wavelengths of light that were received. So for example, the gamma ray wavelengths arrived at a certain time, and of course they traveled 7 billion light years, so that's far. And then the other wavelengths of light, so let's take visible light or something else, they arrived up to 5 seconds later. So the person said, this is the explanation. He says, well, what if somebody questions it and says, well, maybe this wavelength of light left that quasar 5 seconds after that gamma ray wavelength of light left. So that explains why it arrived 5 seconds later. So the person explained why this could not be the case. And so I'll just go right on. And he says, so what this shows was that the speed of light in a vacuum. So we know that if light travels outside of a vacuum, it slows down a bit. And in a vacuum, it has a certain speed that's universal across the universe. So what this person was saying was that the speed of light arrived 5 seconds later because something that happened at the Planck length either disturbed it or caused it to arrive 5 seconds later. So basically, it showed that the speed of light was not constant for every wavelength, and that was a fundamental law of physics, that in vacuum, for every wavelength of light, and that's what physicists have been, I guess, taught, or that what they believe in, at every wavelength of light, light will travel the exact same speed. So, of course, this is heady stuff. This is stuff that the greatest minds in the world think about, and it was so intriguing. It just makes you go on and on to think, well, this is pretty cool how there, first, as I said, there was this theory about quantum foam, and then string theory, and there's other theories, but basically, I think it goes down to explaining, to unifying all the laws of physics. So unifying special relativity, no, sorry, general relativity, gravity, and Einstein's theory of gravity, and quantum mechanics. So this was such an intriguing thing. And of course, if you listen to the professor talk, they know what they're talking about. Okay, so let me read a bit more about, as opposed to me, where I'm not a professor. So anyway, this is more from the WikiLeaks article. In 2009, the MAGIC, or Major Atmospheric Gamma Ray Imaging Cherenkov telescopes, detected that among gamma ray photons arriving from the Blazar Markian 501, this might be the one that he's talking about in the show, some photons at different energy levels arrived at different times, suggesting that some of the photons had moved more slowly, and thus contradicting the theory of general relativity's notion of the speed of light being constant, a discrepancy which could be explained by the irregularity of quantum foam. So I'm not here to tell you how the irregularity of quantum foam makes this makes some photons travel more slowly, but anyway, that's the result of experiment. More recent experiments were, however, unable to confirm the supposed variation of the speed of light due to the graininess of space. Other experiments involving the polarization of light from distant gamma ray bursts have also produced contradictory results. More Earth-based experiments are going and proposed. The large fluctuations characteristic of space-time foam would be expected to occur on a length scale on the order of the Planck length. A foamy space-time would have limits on the accuracy with which distances can be measured because the size of the many quantum bubbles through which light travels will fluctuate. Depending on the space-time model used, the space-time uncertainties accumulate at different rates as light travels through the vast distances. X-ray and gamma-ray observations of quasars using data from NASA's Chandra X-ray Observatory, the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Telescope, and ground-based gamma ray observations from the Very Energetic Radiation Imaging Telescope, ARRAE, VERITAS, show that space-time is uniform down to distances 1,000 times smaller than the nucleus of a hydrogen atom. So again, in this show, the person was talking about when you get down to this quank, or sorry, the Planck length at a scale that is a million billion times smaller than the size of a quark, then some observations are different than one that where it says space-time is uniform down the distances 1,000 times smaller than the nucleus of a hydrogen atom. So the nucleus of a hydrogen atom is much, much, much smaller, or much, much, much bigger than a quark. So you have to look at a scale where, so what they're saying is at some small scales there's no variation, and when you get down to the scale of a million billion times smaller than a quark, then there is variations. So this could account for the observational results that they got. Observations of radiation from nearby quasars by Floyd Stecker of NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center have placed strong experimental limits on the possible violations of Einstein's special theory of relativity implied by the existence of quantum foam. Thus, experimental evidence so far has given us a range of values in which scientists can test for quantum foam. Okay, so I'm not going to go into this because, of course, there's the experts who know about quantum foam, and when they talk, they know what they're talking about. But this is another fascinating exploration into nature itself. And as I said before, I was so intrigued by this string theory. So when it first came out, I tried to read about it. What it said to me was there's certain strings that run throughout the universe, and that could explain a lot of different things. Now, I guess what a lot of this is about is it could be all one big ball of wax where they're saying, well, we're trying to detect or we're trying to test these theories, and when we test these theories, maybe it'll give us some information and maybe it'll lead to something, and then maybe we can unify all the laws of physics. Because, of course, as I said before, and I don't have to say this, scientists know this, that there's no explanations for dark matter, dark energy. We can't see if quantum foam exists, but it's so intriguing that these models are coming out. But as I said before, it seems to go on and on. There's quantum foam, then there's string theory, then maybe there's WIMPs can explain dark energy and dark matter, and there's a new thing I read a few weeks ago where the primordial black holes, their existence, we don't know enough about primordial black holes, and that could explain away what dark energy and dark matter is. So, measurements of quasars at shorter gamma ray wavelengths with Fermi and shorter wavelengths with Veritas rule out a second model called a holographic model with less diffusion. Okay, so anyway, this is something that was really intriguing to me. As I said before, there's so many interesting things that are out there in astronomy, and sometimes you hear a theory and maybe it sounds promising. So here's another explanation of quantum foam. What is quantum foam made of? That something is a rolling collection of virtual particles collectively called quantum foam. According to quantum physicists, virtual particles exist briefly as fleeting fluctuations in the fabric of space-time, like bubbles in beer foam. Now, there's another question. Is space full of quantum foam? So, there's one thought that I had about quantum foam, but I'll just read this first. Look at space under a microscope, and what do you see? Nothing. Magnify 1,000 times, nothing. Magnify 1,000,000 times, nothing. Still nothing. Magnify 1,000,000,000 times, absolutely nothing. At this point, the average person, this says, unblock us. And I said, no, I don't want to unblock you. Okay. At this point, the average person would probably be satisfied with the conclusion that space is, in fact, nothing. This makes intuitive sense, after all. And besides, we're already far beyond the magnification power of real microscopes. But then I think one physicist, I don't recall the name, says in space, in empty space, or what we think is empty space, the most violent and interesting things in physics, in the world of physics, could happen. So I'll read this on now. Quantum physicists aren't average people, however. Armed with theoretical microscopes, they keep on magnifying, gazing deeper and deeper into empty space, until out of nothing they suddenly see something. That something is a roiling collection of vertical particles, virtual particles, collectively called quantum foam. According to quantum physics, virtual particles exist briefly as fleeting fluctuations in the fabric of space-time, like bubbles in beer foam. So what I thought was particles pop in and out of existence all the time, and that's just to satisfy the laws of physics. So I'm going to go on in this article. The bubbles in the quantum foam are quadrillions of times smaller than atomic nuclei and last for infinitesimal fractions of a second, or in quantum speak, the size of a Planck length for a Planck time. Eric Perlman, a professor of physics and space at Florida Institute of Technology, says, something so utterly small has obviously not been directly observed. So why can we be very sure this quantum foam exists? One of the greatest pieces of evidence for it was predicted back in 1947 by Dutch physicists Hendrik Cassimer and Dirk Polder. Fermi Lab senior experimental physicist Don Lincoln explained the so-called Casimir effects for PBS. I'm not sure what PBS is, but anyway. If the quantum foam was real, they reasoned, then the particles should exist everywhere in space. Further, since particles also have a wave nature, there should be waves everywhere. So what they imagined was to have two parallel matter plates placed near one another. The quantum foam would exist between the plates and outside of them. But because the plates were placed near one another, only short waves could exist between the plates, while short and long wavelengths could exist outside them. Because of this imbalance, the excess of waves outside the plate should overpower the small number overpower the small number of waves between them, pushing the two plates together. 30 years after it was first predicted, this effect was observed qualitatively. It was measured accurately in 1997. The idea that space is at its very foundation a frothy chaotic mess has used ramifications for the understanding of our universe. So says Brian Greene, who wrote in this book, The Elegant Universe, it is on such short distance scales that we encounter the fundamental incompatibility between general relativity and quantum mechanics. String theorists and Columbia University professor Brian Greene wrote in his book, The Elegant Universe, the notion of a smooth spatial geometry, the central principle of general relativity, is destroyed by the violent fluctuations of the quantum world on such short distances, end quote, or such short distance scales, end quote. Thus, conclusively demonstrating that quantum foam does not exist would be very useful in sorting out the true nature of reality. But as happens, frustratingly often science, recent experiments disagree. A possible way to test for the presence of quantum foam is to measure how long it takes photons erupting from stellar explosions to travel great distances. Okay, so that's what this person said on TV. We're going to measure something that's 7 billion light years away, then we're going to measure, this is what I believe he said, the wavelength of light coming from that. And if the wavelength of light differs for, or if the arrival time differs for the different wavelengths of light, that tells us something. So I don't want to say exactly what it tells us. But basically what he found was the longer wavelengths, some of the longer wavelengths took up to 5 seconds longer to arrive from a distance of 7 billion light year. If space-time is flat and boring, two photons existed from the same source should take the same time to travel a set distance. But if space-time is foamy, then one photon might get slowed by the slight perturbations. Okay, so that's what I was looking for. It seems that quantum foam exists everywhere throughout the travel time, not just at the source. So I was wondering, well, could this fluctuation at the source, then the photons take off, different wavelength photons, and because something that happened at the source, they would arrive 5 seconds later. But basically what this is saying is that there's quantum fluctuations in space-time throughout the travel of the photons. And so in 2009 analysis found that high energy and low energy photons from the same gamma ray burst arrived at a set location at different time, but two subsequent analysis of other bursts showed little to no variance, indicating that space-time is smooth, or at least not as foamy. So there's different kind of gamma ray bursts, there's different kinds of different wavelengths, so I'm not sure if they're talking about that, but basically I think what the experiments were saying from this person on the TV on this BBC Earth was that they measured a 5 second difference in the arrival time for two different wavelengths of light. So what does that tell us? I'm not sure, but basically, like this article is saying, in Einstein's world, I think what happens is the space-time is smooth, and there's no fluctuations, there's no quantum foam, there's no bumpiness. But in the quantum mechanic field, there is bumpiness. So very fascinating stuff, and another puzzle in physics. And so maybe if I look into it more one day, which will be dangerous, then maybe I could explain more or get an expert to talk about it. But I was going to talk about also one thing that I don't want to give wrong data. But I think what Brian Cox said on the on BBC Earth, atoms first came into existence, I think within 3 seconds or a second or even less than a minute after the Big Bang, and light came into existence maybe millions or millions of years later. And I wanted to get down the exact precise stuff because I have some books and I'm looking for them. I can't find them, because I have hundreds of books. One of them is called The Elegant Universe. Another one's called The First 3 Minutes. So it tells exactly what happened. Well, not exactly, but this is the theories of what happened after the first 3 minutes of the Big Bang, or during the first 3 minutes of the Big Bang, and I really wanted to find, I couldn't find those books, so I hopefully I didn't give them away or sell them or something. I might have, but I hope I didn't. I can find another copy. So anyway, a lot of things in the world of cosmology. So what I'm going to do now, I'm going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more physics, astronomy, and cool stuff on CITR 101.9.
Are you looking for a volunteer opportunity that fits your schedule? Being a big sister takes less time than you think, and you can choose the volunteer opportunity that fits your life. Spend just 1 hour a week as a study buddy, tutor, or 2 hours a week as a big sister. Check out the various mentoring programs at Big Sisters of BC Lower Mainland and find a volunteer position and a little sister that will suit you to a T. Visit bigsisters.bc.ca for more information today.
Hey there.
Barev.
We're the Armenian Students Association, and we're here to bring together everyone,
Armenians and non-Armenians,
who are interested in learning about the Armenian culture here at UBC.
Find us on Facebook at ASAUBC to stay up to date. We look forward to seeing you at our future events.
Hello, welcome, Brock. This is Marco. I was talking about quantum physics. I guess one of the things that I missed mentioning was the cosmological constant and how it's being measured and how there's different values arrived at. And I don't know if that's related to the expansion of the universe. I think it is. It's how fast the universe is expanding. And there's a lot of things in physics that are easy to say, well, this is the definition, but to actually get into the meat of it, it's not so simple unless you're a PhD and you know what you're talking about. So I'll skip with that, but that was one of the things I missed talking about earlier. And I think a lot of it is just to complete all the laws of physics, and the expansion of the universe is one thing that's not in agreement. There's different values that have been arrived at, and I think it's related to dark energy. And so that's the expansion of the universe. And dark matter is related to, I forgot. I'll just keep talking if it pops into my head, okay. And I was going to mention the photoelectric effect, because that was one of the things about quantum physics. I believe the photoelectric effect was first discovered in the 1800s. And Einstein got his Nobel Prize for proving the photoelectric effect. So in 1887, Heinrich Hertz discovered the photoelectric effect. And in 1915, Millikan, Robert A. Millikan, who did not believe in quanta, did an experiment on Einstein's hypothesis. I believe Einstein's hypothesis of the photoelectric effect came in 1907, and it was one of the many experiments or findings in quantum mechanics that revolutionized physics. And I'm not sure if many of the theories that were discovered were understood when they were first discovered, or whether they were accepted. So the broad range of things I talked about today, a lot of it had to do with experiments that were happening in the 1900s, early 1900s, and late 1800s. So I'm going to go on now and talk about something else. And first, but I think I should talk about one more thing, which is what is the photoelectric effect? Because that was one of the key observations. And light, Einstein said, is a beam of particles whose energies are related to their frequencies, according to Planck's formula. So I think it's E equals H, which is Planck's constant, times nu, which is frequency. When that beam of particles is directed at a metal, the photons collide with the atom. If a photon's frequency is sufficient to knock off the electron, the collision produces the photoelectric effect. So what I thought was the photoelectric effect was, it basically, there was a debate in physics about, is light a particle or is light a wave? So I think the photoelectric effect confirmed that light can also act like a particle, not just a wave, because the conclusions in the photoelectric effect was that before that they were talking about it would take a certain frequency to knock an electron out of a metal, and the photoelectric effect proved that. So it's all had to do with light either being a wave or either being a particle like a photon. And I do recall in my physics courses and just in general reading that sometimes light behaves like a particle, sometimes it behaves like a wave, and it almost seems like when it behaves like a particle, light chooses to behave like a particle when it needs to behave like a particle, and when it behaves like a wave, it needs to behave like a wave. I think that makes sense, but anyway, one of the things about the, I guess, Zwicky theory about when electrons were diffracting through two holes was the universe split in two at that time. And Zwicky, Einstein, a lot of people, Chandrasekhar, who theorized that stars could crush themselves out of existence. It was not accepted by Eddington, his senior, I'm not sure what it's called, advisor or teacher. So there are a lot of different theories when they first come into existence that people are almost, they don't want to be associated with because it could ruin their career because they're not accepted and they think, wow. Just like the multiple universe hypothesis, many hypotheses come into existence and then they're maybe not accepted right away. So I was talking about quantum stuff I like to do. So where do I want to go now? I'm going to go to livescience.com and I'm going to talk a little bit about just general astronomy, not so much physics theories like I just talked about the past half hour. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to find some articles. Wow, there's an interesting one. White dwarfs were the crushed corpses of planets in their atmospheres. So I'm going to read that one first. Okay, so what I think is when a star goes nova, maybe they can see the burnt out remnants of the planets in the atmosphere of the white dwarf. Okay, so this is in livescience.com. It's called White Dwarfs Were the Crushed Corpses of Planets in Their Atmosphere by Brandon Spector 3 days ago. So since now, when I'm reading this, it is February 15th. This was on February 12th. So the subtitle is, when a star collapses, it throws its solar system into total chaos. Sometimes that chaos leaves a mark. Astronomers are looking for the bones of dead planets inside the corpses of dead stars. And they may have just found some. In a paper published February 11th in the journal Nature Astronomy, a team of researchers described how they used data from the Gaia space satellite to peer into the atmosphere of four white dwarfs, the shriveled crystalline husks of once massive stars that burned through all their fuel. Swirling among the hot soup of hydrogen and helium surrounding those stars, the team detected clear traces of lithium, sodium, and potassium, metals that are abundant in planetary crusts, in the precise ratio that they'd expect to find inside a rocky planet. So says Mark Hollands, an astrophysicist at the University of Warwick in England, and quote, comparing all these elements together against different types of planetary material in the solar system, we found that the composition was distinctly different from all but one type of material, continental crust. So what they did is they found burnt out crusts. I'm wondering how far this white dwarf is. It's called a white, here's an image, a white dwarf. So it's an illustration. A white dwarf sucks in the rocky remains of an Earth-like planet. According to Holland and his colleagues, the presence of these crusty metals suggests that each of the old faded stars they analyze may once have sat at the center of a solar system not so different from ours. Then, in their dying eons, those stars ripped their solar systems to shreds and gobbled up the remains. Our solar system, too, may share this fate. So I just said it could be a supernova. It's probably not, because when a star goes supernova, it's either it either goes into a neutron star or a black hole, and this is a white dwarf, so it could be a star like our sun. Okay, now here's another subtitle, When Stars Die. Over billions of years, stars with masses between 1/10 and 8 times the mass of the sun burn through their nuclear fuel. When this happens, those old stars shed their fiery outer layers and shrivel into a hot, white, compact core that pack half a sun's worth of mass into a ball no wider than Earth, a white dwarf. So when I said in the beginning it was supernova, I was wrong. I'm sorry. Those smoldering balls, I should have caught that. Those smoldering balls of energy have an extremely strong gravitational pull and are incredibly hot and bright. At first, that is. But the older a white dwarf gets, the cooler and duller it gets, and the more wavelengths of light become visible in its atmosphere. By studying those wavelengths, scientists can calculate the elemental composition of the star's atmosphere. Most white dwarf atmospheres are dominated by either hydrogen or helium, the researchers said, but they can become polluted by other elements if the dead star's intensity gravity, or if the dead star's intense gravity draws the material from the space around it. If a white dwarf happens to suck in the chunks of a broken planet, for example, then any elements in the destroyed object can release their own light, giving a spectral fingerprint that astronomers can potentially spot, Holland says. So again, this is just such fascinating stuff that astronomers can look many light years away, look into the atmosphere of the white dwarf, and tell us whether there was a planet there before or not, and whether the white dwarf has sucked in or burned away the planet's crust. So I don't know if that would happen with Jupiter or Saturn. But again, this is kind of heady stuff. Since the beginning, when the exoplanets had been studied, I believe it was in BC, somewhere in Victoria, that the rocking method where a planet, when they were trying to identify the exoplanet tugs on the star, just like the star tugs on the planet. So the exoplanet imparts a wobble onto the star, and the astronomers first identified that wobble. Then they discovered exoplanets through the transit method. So then I have become aware that if the atmospheres of these planets can be studied, if certain elements are there, for example, we burn hydrocarbons, so there's that fingerprint of hydrocarbons being burnt in our atmosphere. Astronomers can apparently see that, so that is very interesting how they can peer. This four white dwarf is 130 light years away, so they can peer into that atmosphere and get conclusions from that, which is really very fascinating. In their new paper, Holland and his colleagues targeted four old white dwarfs within 130 light years of Earth to see if their atmosphere carried any evidence of planetary remains. Each dead star was between 5 and 10 billion years old and cool enough for the astronomers to detect wavelengths of light emitted by metallic elements shining out of their dim atmosphere. In all four old stars, the researchers detected a combination of lithium and other metals that closely matched the composition of planetary debris. One star, which the team caught an especially clear view of, contained metal in its atmosphere that provided an almost perfect match to the Earth's continental crust, Holland said. Wow, really cool. There's something I should say now that's kind of related, but if I don't say it now, I will forget it. And when I finish this article and I come to try to say it, I'll forget what I was going to say. And guess what? I just forgot. So hopefully as I keep reading, it'll jog my memory and I can remember what I was just going to say. So I'll read on. To the researchers, there is only one logical explanation. The old white dwarfs still hold the smoldering remains of the very planets they once shined their light upon. To end up in a white dwarf's atmosphere, those planetary remains must have been pulled in by the star's intense gravity millions of years ago. After the star finished its stint as a red giant and jettisoned its outer layers of gas into space, Holland said. So I've heard different explanation about what's going to happen to our son. I believe it's practically a foregone conclusion that when our son turns into a red dwarf, or sorry, a red giant, when it starts expanding, it will eat up Mercury, Venus, probably for sure, and Earth. I'm not even sure if it will eat up Earth, but it'll get very close to Earth. And I also read one explanation quite a few years ago that the force of the expanding sun will push our planet farther away from it, so I'm not sure. So if they do go, I think Mercury and Venus will be eaten up, and then maybe Earth, I'm not sure. So says Holland, and quote, after the red giant phase has ended and the sun has become a white dwarf, planetary orbits can become more chaotic as the white dwarf sun has only half of its former mass and the planets are now farther away, end quote. This gravitational disruption increases the risk of planetary collisions, he added, which could fill the solar system with broken rocky remains of dead worlds. Large outer solar system planets, like Jupiter, for example, could then exert their own powerful gravity to send those remains flying out of orbit. Some of them might end up close enough to the white dwarf to get sucked in and amalgamated. While something along these lines seemed to have occurred around the four white dwarfs that Holland studied, it's anyone's guess whether Earth will ever meet a similar fate. According to study co-author Boris Gansecki, also a professor at the University of Warwick, it's likely that our planet will get swallowed up during the sun's red giant phase, leaving no elements behind for alien astronomers to detect. So what it's saying here, if the planet gets swallowed up, then basically there's nothing to detect. But if the red giant swells up and doesn't engulf Earth or Mars, it could somehow burn up those planets or break up those planets. And then when this happens, trace elements could be found in the atmosphere of the white dwarf. That's when it cools, that is. However, that doesn't mean these extraterrestrial telescopes will come up empty-handed. So says Gansecki, and quote, I wouldn't bet on those alien atmospheres detecting the lithium of all the defunct Teslas in the solar white dwarf. But there is a good chance they could see asteroids, comets, moons, or even Mars being gobbled up, end quote. So that's the end of this article. So basically there is still a lot of time before any of this would happen. It's probably 5 billion years from now when the sun threatens Earth. But it will threaten Earth in 500 million years because it'll get so hot on Earth, all the water will evaporate and the day of the animals on Earth will come to an end. Okay, now I'm going to talk about this because it's kind of astrophysics, which I talked about earlier, or cosmology. This is from Life Science. It's by Stephanie Pappas, Life Science contributor, 5 days ago, which is February 9th. And it says, particles zipping around Earth at near light speed, finally explained. The electrons are trapped in the endless loop around the planet. I read something about this many years ago. So this is an illustration of the Earth's Van Allen belts with the trajectories of ultra-relativistic electrons in gray. The colorful loops in the foreground are the orbits of satellites that must pass through this electromagnetically dangerous area of space. So let me see this. The ultra-relativistic electrons are in gray. It's hard to see what that is. But anyway, in the swirl of a perfect solar storm, electrons can get trapped near Earth, where they can accelerate to nearly the speed of light. These electrons get their zip from surfing on waves of superheated charged gas called plasma that gets launched from the sun during the solar storms. They accelerate to near light speed, though only when the plasma density is low, according to a new study led by researchers from GFZ, German Center for Geosciences in Potsdam. So again, this article is called Particles Zipping Around Earth at Near Light Speed, finally explained. It's dated February the 9th of this year. Yes, okay. These findings are important because electrons traveling so quickly are particularly dangerous to satellites and other electronic equipment. They can penetrate the shielding that protects satellites from other charged particles in solar storms, damaging sensitive components. And of course, they can damage sensitive humans, right? Okay. Now let's go down. There's a video here, so if you want to see this, the guy is talking about solar radiation and the particles zipping around at near light speed. The phenomena occurs in the two Van Allen radiation belts, which are loops of charged particles trapped in a kind of donut shape around Earth. The belts, which extend from about 400 miles to more than 36,000 miles above Earth's surface, protect our planet from charged particles emanating from the sun, but they also react to solar systems in ways that aren't fully understood. In 2012, NASA launched two Van Allen probes to take measurements in the mysterious zone of near space. The probes detect electrons at ultra-relativistic energies, in other words, traveling near the speed of light. Researchers weren't sure how the electrons were becoming so energetic. Some thought the electrons must be accelerating in two stages. First, on a journey from outside the outer region of the belts, and then again deep inside them. But new data from the Van Allen probes found that two stages aren't necessary. Instead, the electron speed has everything to do with the density of background levels of plasma during a solar storm. So I wonder how fast electrons can get, because there is a limiting, as they get closer to the speed of light, I think, don't their masses increase? And that's what would be the limiting factor in sending a spacecraft, is if we get close to the speed of light, the faster you approach the speed of light, the more the spacecraft would approach the weight or the mass of infinity, or the weight of infinity. So I wonder how fast electrons can travel. So says co-author Yuri Fritz, a space physicist at GFZ Potsdam, and quote, "This study shows that electrons in the Earth's radiation belt can be promptly accelerated locally to ultra-relativistic energies if the conditions of the plasma environment, plasma waves, and temporary low plasma density are right," end quote. Okay, whatever that means. So that just means they can be accelerated if the plasma waves are at the right density. Okay. Typically, the density of plasma within the Van Allen belts might be between 50 and 100 particles per cubic centimeter. But when the density drops to less than 10 particles per cubic centimeter, electrons can draw energy from electromagnetic waves, known as chorus waves, boosting their kinetic energy from a few thousand electron volts to 7 million electron volts. For comparison, the linear accelerator used up to 2020 at CERN accelerates protons up to 50 million electron volts. So much higher at CERN. Researchers already suspected the chorus waves might be the culprit for accelerating the electrons, but had not previously realized that this could only happen when plasma density was so low. The low density seems to allow more efficient transfer of energy from the waves to the electrons. These density drops don't happen very often, the researchers wrote in their paper published January 29 in the Science Advances. In 2015, when the observations were taken, the right conditions appeared only a handful of times. These extreme conditions may have something to do with the prolonged convection in the Van Allen belts, which is when hotter, lighter material is rising and dense, cooler material is sinking, but more study is needed to find out why the plasma occasionally thins so much. So that was something about the Van Allen belt. But what really got my blood flowing was that talk earlier about this quantum phone and I guess it's called cosmology, and also astrophysics, I think, is very interesting, but cosmology really got me going. So I didn't have as much fun reading the reading this as I did about the what did I talk about the first hour? Now I don't even remember. But anyway, yes, I talked about Okay, I'm going to force myself to try to think what I talked about. Okay, I'll go on. And one thing I was going to talk about with Brian Cox was he was somewhere where a meteor was discovered. And when the meteor was cut in half, what they found was amino acids in there. So Brian Cox said the early Earth was just a big rock, no water, no life, nothing. So it's possible the life, the amino acids, and of course the water was delivered by comets that struck the Earth. And a lot of it was probably in the late heavy bombardment. And back at that time when Earth was just a barren rock, apparently Venus had a nice spring or summery days on its surface. And Mars, too, had a lot of water, and it's speculated it's possible there was life.